important things that weren't covered in the history that Charlotte Stern wrote that I'd like to go into detail with you. And that was the details of how the Bureau was structured and how various things happened. For instance, when it was formed, you used as the motto the Joint Sanitary Control Board. Is that right?
We used the policy of a joint employer labor setup for agreements on occupational diseases and safety as the model.
Now, when it was formed by you and Harriet Silverman, is that correct? And
it was formed by a labor committee, which made an agreement with us for research. They were the initiators.
They initiated it
on the basis of their serious occupational hazards, and that was the Joint Council of New York of the Brotherhood of Painters, Decorators, Paperhangers. That was the initiator.
Oh, I see. So they approached the two of you, was that it at the time, or the three of you?
I assume that following our work with the garment, the ladies' garment work, and following the new setup, which I can't think of right now, you know, where I went to follow up my work, that we contacted the painters as to their problems, and then they initiated.
I see.
And assessed their members and made the first contact. And then we set up the technical advisory committee, and then we set up the medical department where they could be examined. And then it moved from there to the painters all over the country, all of whom helped finance the research work. And then it moved from there through our occupational disease contacts and the committee we set up, and that is Henderson and Haggard at Yale, Alice Hamilton, C.E.A. Winslow, who did the Hatters thing, and Hayhurst of Ohio. It moved into these other fields,
mm-hmm.
all of whom contributed. And in addition to the setup we had for the painters and the medical examinations, we then set up later this medical department for the Textile workers.
Now, the initial funds to establish the Bureau came solely from the Joint Council of Painters?
From the affiliated labor organizations. The initial funds came from the New York Painters and their international and their national affiliates all over the country.
Now, there was mention in the history of the American Fund for Public Service, which seemed to have been involved in funding the Bureau.
I don't know what that was at this time. I'd have to go back and look through the whole thing.
You don't have
But the funds were used initially to pay the director, who was a physician.
And who was
and,
that?
Hmm?
Who, what was the name of that physician?
Well, it's in the thing. I don't, can't remember it now. It's all in the material. His picture and everything is in that folder. He was a physician, and he was placed in charge. And then we had to rent the X-ray equipment and all that material, and the money was used to finance this. And then we had free laboratory service from the New York City Health Department, and a good deal of volunteer service from the medical profession. All of this was volunteer.
Now, were the advisory council volunteer, or were they paid?
Who?
The advisory council.
No, they weren't paid anything.
They
it was all volunteer.
And now, was this health department exclusively for the painters then?
This one was.
That one. Mm-hmm.
This was the one that examined some 500 painters, and the records were analyzed by Alice Hamilton and Emery Hayhurst, and they were publicized in that pamphlet which had the picture on the top of it. And then this mass meeting was called in New York. 4,000 painters covered by the New York District Council, which included all of the locals in that council. And it was addressed by Dr. Hamilton. And the policy was established by her that while efforts were being made to put into operation the safeguards in the paints and in the spray material, the first thing to do was to reduce exposure. And the recommendation was made at the mass meeting that a 5-day week should be adopted jointly between the union and the employers to reduce exposure. That was the first thing to do, at least give a man 2 days in which he is not exposed.
Mm-hmm.
To build up his resistance and to reduce the intensity of the exposure. And that was the first 5-day week that was ever in operation in the country.
And that was the first joint agreement that came out of your efforts then,
that
too.
Was the first joint agreement.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you moved from the painters to the next project, was the money, the funding for the next project still basically the funds that the painters were putting in?
There was no funding necessary because the work with the Dan DeVary Hatters was taken care of by Winslow through his position in the U.S. Public Health Service and his position at Yale and his having gotten through the Connecticut law, the compensation for occupational diseases.
Now, what was the assessment of the union members?
Well, it's written down there. I don't I can't give it to you off my head.
Because I came across two different figures. I came across 25 cents and then somewhere else something about $3 per capita.
It was 25 cents times the number of months it became. It was $3 a year.
Oh, I see. It was 25 cents a month.
That's right.
I see. Okay.
12 times 25 is $3.
Okay. Now, when the painters contracted you, were the three of you involved at that time, or was it just you and Harriet Silverman?
We started with Harriet Silverman and myself.
And then Charlotte Stern joined
then
later?
Then later, when she left her position with the Jewish Welfare in Boston, she came on.
And now, what you mentioned the other day, that the three of you had different kinds of functions. Now, what was the difference between how you operated? Did you do different
jobs?
Well,
I gave you that the other day.
Well, we had just touched on it while we were eating, and I wondered
no,
if you
I said that I handled the statistical material, but Harriet Silverman gave the emotional impact because she was a great orator, and she appealed to audiences. And Dr. Hamilton was very much impressed with her because of her personality. And when Charlotte came in, she did a great deal of the out-of-area contacts. We did a great deal of traveling, all of us.
All of you.
Covering the different areas on invitation.
Now, there was a mention in the report to the executive committee that there was three secretaries, an organizing secretary, an education secretary, and the executive secretary.
Well, that was the three of them.
Now, which were each of you? You were the education secretary then?
Well, it was all research.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Harriet was the educational. And I was the research. And I don't know what Charlotte was. It was the third.
She may have been the organizing secretary.
She was probably the organizing secretary.
Now.
And the three of them were paid. I mean the two of them, I wasn't paid.
Oh, you were not paid?
No,
I
see. It was all volunteer on my part.
I see. Was it because there were not enough funds to pay?
No, I never was paid for my service from the time I entered the whole labor movement, except by the Joint Board of Sanitary Control for flushing toilets and making those reports. We were paid. I was paid as part-time educational secretary there. Harriet was the educational secretary. And for my work in evening classes with the members of the union and by the joint board for the work of checking violations.
Mm-hmm. Now,
but not under the thing we set up. That was volunteer.
So the two of them were paid, and there was some office help as well?
I think there must have been. Yes, there was. There was a technical person to run mimeograph machine and type and stuff like that. And she was paid. And that was all there was, to staff.
Now, once other unions joined, after the painters, how was the governing body formed, the body that made the decision?
They decided who was to represent them.
But each union had so many representatives, was that it?
Well, it depended on what the problem was.
But for instance, this trade union council that became the governing body, is that it?
Yes.
Now, that was not formed right away, though, was it?
It wasn't formed until more than the painters came in. It developed on the basis of which studies were being made and where and what they wanted from us. And then they established their own. That's all in the material that you got.
Thank you. And then the specific trade to study was determined simply by a union who was involved would make a request?
Yes, sir. The request would come to us.
Now, how would you, did you ever have to make a choice of there being two demands at the same time?
No.
Oh.
Because we had the technical advisory people, and they gave the information, and the material was set up in these little pamphlets we sent out, you know, trade by trade. They're all in there. And then they determined what they wanted. And in some instances, they were able to negotiate an agreement, and in other instances, they were not. And the building trades was probably the most comprehensive, because that was carried on with the National, I gave it to you before.
Institute
of Architects. And they put all their machinery into it. And with the, at that time, I think it was the state. New York State Industrial Department. What's her name?
Of Industrial Safety.
Perkins.
Frances Perkins.
Frances Perkins. And the Institute of Architects in Dublin from the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And that was taken care of and paid for by them. It didn't take any funds from us at all.
I see.
That was funded entirely by the building trades themselves and the cooperating state and national organizations because of the serious injuries in building construction and the fact that there were no standards.
Now, those were the two major joint agreements and the painters and the building trades. Were you able to successfully provide material for other joint agreements?
There was a great deal of conflict between the standards and the willingness of the employers to comply. And so it was difficult to get joint agreements. We had one with the machinists in the naval station in, can't think of the state, Rhode Island, I think it was, if you have all that material. And that was official, and that was a government agreement, because they were able to do that. We may have had one with the Ohio Potteries, I don't know, I'd have to go back. I don't think it's material. I think the important thing is that the standards were set. There was no federal law on occupational diseases. There was no building trades code. This building trades code became the standard for Canada and for certain states, New York, and I think New Mexico or someplace down there. You have all that material. And that was done with the active support of the life insurance companies, because they were, whatever could be done to save lives and cut down their costs was helpful to them. And Metropolitan was very active at that time, Dublin in New York, and we worked very closely with him.
Now, for instance, in the case of the Danbury Hatters,
that was done entirely on the compensation cases. You have all that information.
Well, you had come up with another, with a substitute for the mercury.
That had nothing to do with it. That came much later.
Oh, I see.
It was the bringing of those 100 cases under the Connecticut law, which was handled by Winslow. All we had to do was to gather the material on mercury poisoning, which was furnished to us by our consultant.
A study was conducted outside of New York City.
There was no study conducted outside of New York City.
Well, for instance, collecting the information on Danbury.
That was a workman's compensation case. It had nothing to do with a study.
But you collected that information, didn't you?
The material was already there in the hands of the publications of the experts that we had.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about the Passaic study, for instance, of a textile?
That was done in New York. We set up another office with an x-ray machine and an office similar to the one we had with the painters in another location.
Oh, I see. So the textile workers would come.
They came in and they were examined for tuberculosis and other things, and the information was given to them, and they took care of it.
I see. So you wouldn't go to the town and do the study there?
Oh, no. It was all done in New York.
I see.
We only set up two medical examination programs. One was the painters, and the other was the Passaic textile.
And in the other cases where you have to get information, for instance, in Ohio with the potters, someone
came through Hayhurst.
I see. Since he was in Ohio, he would get.
He was the head of the Department of Occupational Diseases of the Ohio State University, and he was one of our consultants.
Then he would send you the information, and your responsibility would be to compile it and write up the report.
That's right. And he wrote up the report. He analyzed the findings.
And then where would your responsibilities begin?
To make it available to the union and to the state. Well, it was available to the state.
And then when there were efforts at changes in legislation, that would be done through your office, though?
We didn't appear before legislative bodies except in New York through Francis Perkins. It was done by the unions in their respective states.
You would just provide the union with the information.
We would provide the union with the information. And it was up to them to see that their state legislators adopted than necessary laws.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of this health department that was set up for the painters, did it only function during the period of the study, or did it become an ongoing health service for the painters?
No. It was, the study was made, and then the medical department was ended.
Now, did any of the unions that were involved with you actually start instituting health committees as you had recommended?
Well, they all had health committees.
And they had health programs within the union?
Of course, that's what was generated. Mm-hmm. And all this was put together at the Cleveland Conference. It's all published, and the whole machinery is there, what was done, and everything. That was the second national conference. One, I think, was in New York. It's all in that material you had there.
Okay. Now, there was a mention of, during the 1925 strikes, providing strike support. Now, how was that done exactly?
I don't know what you're referring to.
I think, for one, there was the United Mine Workers, I think, were on strike then. She mentions in that little history providing strike services, and I didn't know what that meant exactly.
Well, that was Harriet Silverman. She handled the mine workers and her reporters in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's an important thing. Whatever the union asked us to do in the way of data was given to them. And what they used it for was their business.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't in any way take over the functions of the unions. Their own committees took care of their own functions. We didn't superimpose anything on the labor affiliates. All we did was provide them with information. The responsibility for what they did with it was theirs.
Now, could you trace for me the relationship to the AFL that culminated in their not cooperating? But in the beginning, was there cooperation with the AFL, or did it, from the very beginning, did you have problems?
We had no problems at all. Unions belonged to the AFL at that time. There was no CIO. There was no conflict within the union.
Well, at the national level, the National Federation?
There was no conflict whatsoever.
Well, I thought you had difficulty getting their support.
No, we had their support. What happened was that when was the meeting in Cleveland? Whatever it was, you have the date. A depression had set in, and the labor was more concerned with whether they had jobs than whether they had occupational diseases, because if they weren't working, that wasn't their problem. And the whole labor movement moved into the sphere of getting national legislation for Social Security and old age pensions, and that was their motivation.
You see, it seems from some of the material I've looked at that as early as 1925, you were having some difficulties with the AFL at a convention. One of you, it just says the director, was going to give a speech and never was able to. Then it went to the Education Committee, and then the chairman of the Education Committee finally said that even though they recognized the work of the Bureau, they withheld endorsement on the ground that it was privately conducted body. Now, that was as early as 1925.
Well, there's always that apprehension on the part of organized labor that their functions might be taken over or at least interfered with by an agency which was outside of their control, which was not a part of the American Federation of Labor. And our only connection with organized labor was through those unions, state conventions, which was like the Ohio Federation of Labor, the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor, that were part of our labor organization.
Well, did the refusal of the endorsement of the National Federation then make it more difficult to get more...
Well, that didn't happen until after the Cleveland Convention.
Because, see, she indicates that as early as 1925.
Well, the convention was in 26, as far as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Now, why exactly were they concerned that you were usurping their position? You were really a group that was contracted by labor, weren't you? In other words, it was the trade unions who would contract you to...
Yes, but the American Federation of Labor is made up of international unions, state labor organizations, regional organizations, central labor councils, and they are responsible to the international. We were a service organization, and they could accept us as a service organization, or they could reject us as a service organization if they felt that we were interfering with their jurisdiction. And as we went on, and as we became stronger from the point of view of the number of affiliations, the character of the affiliations, the international unions, the state federations, so forth, the apprehension that they could not control our policies grew, and the decision to pull out those labor organizations over which they had control. They don't control all of them, but those over which they control made it impossible to continue.
Now, once they refused to endorse, A local council would have a difficult time then staying in other words.
Well, it would depend on what happened to their international organization in relation to the American Federation of Labor. It's a jurisdictional decision.
Now,
anyway, our work had been completed.
You didn't feel that there were other industries that should still be studied?
Our work had been completed. We had set the standards for the major industries. We had set the standards for the building trades. We had set the standards for the International Brotherhood of Painters. All the material was there, and it was up to them to use it. Our work had been completed. It could have gone on, but very likely, because of the economic situation, the unemployment situation, and the fact that concentration had to be focused on getting Social Security, federal Social Security legislation, pension, and so forth. But the whole emphasis was being shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Was being shifted from whether a man was getting lead poisoning or whether a man had a job. And this is quite obvious.
But the real problem around your survival really was almost a power struggle between the National Federation.
It was a question as to whether the National Federation, whether the American Federation of Labor wanted to set up a Department of Occupational Health and Safety. And they did not set such a structure up until after the American Cancer Society put on a labor advisory committee, which was in 1969, I think, until the Harrison-Williams bill went through in 1970 and was signed by the president. Then the organized labor movement moved in to set up their own trade-by-trade occupational health and safety committees.
So there was almost a 40-year period then of...
It was a period which started with the Depression and moved into the question of workmen's compensation, attorneys representing labor and attorneys representing employers to see who could get the most out of a case, which is still the case.
Mm-hmm. How did
it moved into that field and into changes in workmen's compensation laws, enactments by states to include occupational diseases, which moved from state to state. It had started with Wisconsin, the second state was Connecticut, and then the third, I think, was Ohio, but one state after the other included occupational diseases. So there's a whole change in federal structure and in economics. And then, so the emphasis was changed. And there was really nothing more for us to do under those conditions until labor saw fit to follow the policy that was first initiated by the shirtwaist workers in New York. And the amalgamated clothing workers got into the same thing. The Price group took them in. I think they took some other people in, too, into their program. So there was a hiatus there, which could only be bridged by organized labor itself.
Mm-hmm.
And was not bridged until the occupational Safety and Health Act went through in December of 1969, became effective in 1970. Isn't that clear?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be wrong in the tape to attempt to develop some kind of a schism and to blame the labor movement, which was involved in its own problems, in its own contracts for wages and hours and things of that kind, which was its primary function, for concentrating on what they felt at that time was their main function, and protecting the labor movement from being we had the right to work laws and all this thing going on, and they were fighting for their life.
But your point in the Workers' Health Bureau was basically that the health concerns should be as important part of the negotiations as the economic concerns. And this was never really adopted except in those few cases. It was never really adopted.
It never became a national policy of the American Federation of Labor until after they had made their agreement with the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which also was started out with the United Mine Workers sending staff in to organize the steel workers and the packing house workers, and that was in 1933. And there was this conflict of two national labor organizations, which had to be settled. The teachers were in the CIO. The newspaper guild was in the CIO. The steel workers were in the CIO. The packing house workers were in CIO. And this was a national labor survival situation which had to be determined, and it was determined by forming the AFL-CIO, which is what we have today. And it wasn't until the adoption of the National Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970 that the committees within the international unions were formed. And that was probably triggered initially by the cancer situation.
So the CIO,
because the cancer was, this was the thing that was destroying thousands and thousands and thousands of workers, all the asbestos fibers and the cancer and the chemical things in cancer. And the reporter has had all this stuff in its pages in the last 2 years, 3 years, through the cooperation of Tabashaw and